warning me to shut up or else. What took you so long to open the bloody door? He hissed.
He's had enough, Sully. A deep, surly voice said from somewhere in the room.
Is it enough? Let him go.
Don't do it again, understand?
My assailant snarled, bringing the flashlight so close to my eyes they seemed to cook. I blinked repeatedly.
I won't do it again, I said with bated breath.
Where are your parents? My assailant hissed.
I don't know.
I felt I had to protect my parents, no matter what. You're lying to me, boy.
We'll find them, Sully. Let him go. We'll find them.
My assailant let go of me, and I slumped to the floor, spent with fear. I felt the side of my head. It was bruised and swollen, and something pounded like tribal drums inside my ears. My head no longer felt like my head, but like a dead weight on my torso. I coughed and spit, and the spittle was all red with blood. My body was wet and slippery with sweat, urine, and blood, as if I had been soaked in grease. Feeling dizzy, I leaned against the crate, disbelieving all that was happening, thinking it all a dream, a bad dream, a nightmare, expecting to awake any time and find that I was unscathed, that nothing had happened. The lightheadedness dissolved, and I was able to lift my head up again. I saw the two policemen searching the kitchen, kicking chairs, crates, boxes, tins, pots, dishes, rags, cardboard, searching under the table, behind the cupboard, behind the door, in the corners, everywhere, cursing how shabby the place looked and how everything was hindering their search. Finding no one in the kitchen, they went for the bedroom door, where my sister cowered in screams. My heart fluttered, my skin prickled, and the tightness in my throat returned. I felt a thick lump of fear force its way down my tight throat into my tight stomach, where it settled. One of the policemen grabbed my sister and shoved her away from the door. My sister screamed hysterically and flailed her arms as her owlish eyes searched wildly about the kitchen. She saw me and rushed toward me, urine streaming down her legs. The policeman who had shoved her away now barred her way with his long arms outspread like the wings of some prehistoric bird. He gritted his gleaming teeth at her.
Where do you think you're going, you little bastard?
My sister whirled and dove under the table and curled into a tight knot of screaming, helpless, naked fear. There was nothing I could do to protect her or myself. The policeman went over to the table and shook a truncheon in her face, warning her to shut up or else. But my sister was beside herself with fear and did not let up screaming. The policeman left her and strode across the room to the broken window to glance outside. The second policeman, meanwhile, was struggling to open the bedroom door. Apparently, my parents had bolted it from within.
Open up! He rapped on the door. Open up or we'll break it down. We know you in there.
He then paused, expecting his order to be carried out by whomever he thought was inside. It was not. He again seized the doorknob and twisted it violently, but still it would not open. He started pounding the door with his fist and kicking it with his steel-rimmed boots.
Hey, you bastard!
The policeman, peering through the window, turned to me and demanded to know who was in the bedroom.
My brother, I said softly.
Speak up. And who else?
I don't know.
You're lying to me again, boy, he hissed,
and started toward me with a raised truncheon. "Your parents are in there, aren't they? No use protecting them, boy, for we'll find them. And when we do," he smiled fiendishly, "you'll get it." I remained silent, resigning myself to the worst. "Now will you stop lying to me, boy?" He shook the truncheon in my face. I tried to say something, to trump up an excuse. My mouth opened wide, but no words came out. The policeman lifted his truncheon, and I closed my eyes, expecting a blow. It didn't come. The policeman instead told his comrade to smash the bloody thing. The other policeman was about to do that anyway, for he had taken several steps away from the door. He flung himself at the door, bursting it at the butt hinges. Streams of perspiration poured down my face. I could scarcely breathe. The policeman had been so thorough in rummaging the kitchen that I had no doubt they would find my parents. There was no way they could possibly have escaped. The window was latticed with iron bars, and there was only the one door. "There's someone under the bed!" the policeman in the bedroom shouted triumphantly. "Haul him out!" the policeman by the kitchen window shouted back as he left his station for the bedroom. "Come out of there, old man! Out! Out!" As he passed me, the policeman who had been standing by the window gave me a wicked look and grinned. "Hurry up, old man! Come out of there!" the policeman in the bedroom said impatiently. "Hurry, hurry! We haven't got all day."
"I'm coming, Nkosi, Lord," my father whimpered.
They'd found him.
My mother was sure to be next. What would happen to us children if they took both my mother and father away?
"Who's in there with him? Where's your wife, old man?"
I inched slowly toward the bedroom door, taking care not to attract the attention of the policeman.
"I said, where's your bloody wife, old man?"
The question was repeated.
She's at work, Nkosi,"
my father said plaintively. He was standing, naked and head bowed, in the middle of the bedroom. To his right was an old, worn-out wardrobe. To his left, a trundle bed with a straw twin-size mattress, upon which George lay, bowling. In front of the bed was an old, flecked brown table, against which my father's interrogator leaned, as he flashed his light all over my father, keeping him blinking all the time.
"At this time of the night?"
The question came slowly, ringing with incredulity.
"Yes, Nkosi." "What job does she do at 2 o'clock in the morning?"
"She's a kitchen girl, Nkosi. She sleeps in. She's a maid in Edenvale." The interrogator muttered something to himself, then said,
"Come, let's see your pass."
My father reached for his tattered overalls at the foot of the bed, and from the back pocket he removed a small, square, bulky black book and handed it over to the policeman, who hurriedly flipped through it. Stonily, running his eyes up and down my father, he said,
"The bloody thing is not in order, you know."
"Yes, Nkosi. I know that very much. I didn't pay my poll tax. I was meaning to do so."
"It's not only your poll tax, damn it, old man. Many other things are wrong with it. You know that?"
"Yes, Nkosi," my father whimpered. "I know that very much. I was meaning to fix them too."
"And I see here that you haven't paid your travel tax too. Were you meaning to fix that too?"
the policeman said sarcastically. "Yes, Nkosi." My father's brow started to sweat.
"And the stamp on page 15 says you're supposed to have a wife here in the city," the policeman said triumphantly, looking at us children.
all the time brandishing the bulky black book in my father's face.
"What have you to say to that hair? How are you going to fix that hair?"
My father became speechless. He parted his parched lips and tried to say something, but no sound came. He lowered his bony head and buried it in the palms of his gnarled hands. And at that moment, he seemed to age 1,000 years, a pitiful sight. The policeman playfully prodded my father's penis with a truncheon. I gasped with horror.
"Old man,"
the policeman said floutingly, throwing his head backward.
"You're an old man, aren't you?"
My father, only in his mid-30s, nodded.
"You're as ancient as my father. Yet your irresponsibility makes me ashamed of saying that. Why isn't your pass in order?"
"Mine is. Anyway, look here. As an old man, you ought to be back in the Bantustan. My father is back there and living in peace. What are you still doing in the city but asking for trouble?" The policeman confirmed my suspicions of his being fresh from a tribal reserve. The authorities preferred his kind as policemen because of their ferociousness and blind obedience to white authority. They harbored a twisted fear and hatred of urban blacks. They knew nothing of black solidarity, relishing only the sense of raw power being a policeman gave them over their own kind.
"I'm working, Kosi," my father said. "There are no jobs in the Bantustan."
"No jobs in the Bantustan?" the policeman laughed. "What about raising cattle? Or have you forgotten how to do that since coming to the city?"
My father did not answer. He continued gazing at the floor.
"A lot of things are wrong with your pass, and you can be endorsed out at any time. You know that?"
"Yes, Nkosi. I know that very much."
"Then what do you think we should do with you?" My father forced a fake smile. It was not a spontaneous smile. My father never smiled. It was a begging smile, a passive acceptance of the policeman's authority. After smiling, my father again dropped his eyes to the floor. He seemed uncharacteristically powerless and contrite, a far cry from the tough, resolute, and absolute ruler of the house I knew him to be, the father whose words were law. I felt sorry for him. The policeman, still brandishing the bulky black book, leaned into my father's ear and whispered something. The other policeman, meantime, was still at the door jamb, reveling at the sight of my father being humiliated. The emotional and physical nakedness of my father somehow made me see him in a different light. He seemed a stranger, a total alien. Watching him made tears surge to my eyes, but I fought desperately to keep them from flowing. "I cannot cry," I told myself. "I would not cry. I should not cry in front of these black beasts." For the first time in my life, I felt hate and anger rage with furious intensity inside me. What I felt was no ordinary hate or anger. It was something much deeper, much darker. Frightening, something even I couldn't understand. As I stood there watching, I could feel that hate and anger being branded into my 5-year-old mind, branded to remain until I die. "Hurry up, old man," the interrogator said, as my father fidgeted with his overalls. "We haven't got all day. Do you have it or don't you?" he said, trying to wring a bribe out of my father.
"Nkosi, I beg you, my father whimpered, drooping his bony shoulders and letting the overalls dangle limply at his side.
I have no money, he sighed.
Nothing? The policeman cried, astonished. The black policemen were used to getting bribes.
Nothing, Kosi, my father said, slowly running his right hand through his kinky hair. Not a cent. I have no job. I just applied for a permit to look for a job yesterday.
Well, frowned the policeman, closing the bulky book in my father's face. I gave you a chance. You refused it.
Now hurry up and put on your clothes and come with us. It's number 4 for you, old man.
But the little ones, that's none of my bloody business. The policeman cut in sharply. Tell that to the magistrate. Now hurry up and get dressed.
My father jumped into his overalls. He was handcuffed.
Go quiet your brother, he said as he saw me staring at him.
I did not go. I watched impassively as they led him through the front door, his head bowed, his hands manacled, his self-esteem drained, his manhood sapped. I wondered where they were taking him. What grievous wrong had he committed, deserving of being shackled? What type of fiends the two policemen were? They weren't human to me. Neither were they black. Though I feared them as one would fear monsters, I didn't let fear panic me, for I hated them more than I feared them.
Curious to find out where they were taking my father and what was going on outside, I followed them, forgetting all about my mother. I ordered my sister, who was crying, "Papa, Papa," by the door, back into the house. I stepped outside in time to see the two policemen flanking my father go up a rocky slope leading out of the yard. I saw more black policemen leading black men and women out of shacks. Some of the prisoners were half naked, others dressed as they went. Several children, 2 and 3 years old, stood in tears outside smashed doors, imploring their mothers and fathers to come back. In the middle of the yard, an old man was being shoved by a black policeman for being slow. A woman was being kicked by another black policeman for being stubborn. Another woman was being ordered to leave a bawling infant behind. Several red-necked white men in safari suits and fatigues, guns drawn, paced briskly about the entrance gate, shouting orders and supervising the roundup. I avoided them by going around the shacks. I passed on my way to the gate shacks whose windows had been shattered, whose doors had been busted. The interior of some of the shacks were a mess, as if a tornado had hit. I arrived at the gate and found a group of boys in a half circle on a stoop overlooking the street. Dawn was starting to break, but stars still twinkled faintly in the distant, pale eastern sky. Patco buses droned in the distance, carrying loads of black humanity to the white world to work. I joined the group of boys. My eyes wandered up, then down the street. I gasped at what I saw down the street. A huge throng of handcuffed black men and women, numbering in the hundreds, filled the narrow street from side to side. The multitude, murmuring like herds of restless cattle, was being marched by scores of black policemen and a dozen or so white ones, some of whom had fierce police dogs on leashes, toward a row of about 10 police vans and trucks parked farther down the street. More handcuffed men and women were still filing out of the yards on either side, swelling the ranks of those already choking the streets. It seemed as if the entire population of Alexandra had been arrested. As I stood there, open-mouthed with fearful anticipation, watching the handcuffed men and women being shoved, jostled, kicked, and thrown like bundles into the trucks and vans, along with the dogs, I saw, out of the corner of my eye, a short, pot-bellied black policeman leading a naked black man with bony, stilt-like legs, out of an outhouse in a yard across the street. The naked man pleaded that he be allowed to go and dress, but the fat policeman simply roared with laughter and prodded the naked man in the back with a truncheon, telling him that it was not his fault that he had caught him naked. "Next time, hide with your clothes on, brother," the policeman jeered. The boys around me giggled at the sight of the naked man being marched down the street, toward the throng of handcuffed men and women, his gnarled hands cupped between his bony legs. I remained silent. A tall black man standing by the gate to one of the yards overlooking the street. One of the few adults left behind, presumably because his papers were in order, saw the naked man and instantly dashed into his house and came out waving a pair of tattered overalls. He hurled them across the donga, and they landed in the middle of the street, a few paces from the approaching policeman and his naked captive. Grudgingly, amid shouts of, "Hurry up, we haven't got all day," intended to please the group of women prisoners gaping at the scene from a short distance, the policeman allowed the naked man to pick up the overalls. He dressed in the middle of the street. Meanwhile, the trucks and vans, now jam-packed with handcuffed men and women and dogs and black policemen, hummed engines and prepared to leave. More handcuffed men and women and policemen and dogs still remained in the streets. Within minutes, more vans and trucks came, and the loading was finally completed. The convoy of vans and trucks sped away in a huge cloud of dust, with several of the black policemen dangling from the side and rear doors like rags on a line. As the group dispersed, some of the boys started talking in soft, subdued tones. "They've taken my father away. They've taken my mother and father. They've taken my brother. They've taken my sister. They've taken my whole family. They've taken my aunt and uncle. They've taken my mother and left my father after he had given them some money." "Mother? Where was my mother? All along I had been oblivious of her." Remembering that the police did not find her when they searched the house, I ran back home as fast as I could to try and find her. I found my brother and sister still crying, but I ignored them. "Mama, where are you?" I shouted, standing in the middle of the bedroom. "They're gone." No reply. I repeated the shout. The wardrobe creaked and a voice inside softly asked, "Are they gone?" Instantly, I leaped back. My eyes popped out in fearful astonishment. "Mama? Is that you?" I warily approached the wardrobe. "Yes, let me out." "Mama? Are you in there?" I said, to make sure that I had indeed heard her voice. I could not believe she had hidden herself in so small a wardrobe. My sister and I often had trouble fitting in there whenever we played hide and seek. "Yes, let me out." "It's locked, Mama. Where's the key?" My mother told me that my father had it. I told her he was gone. She remained silent for a moment or two and then told me to look for it on the table. I looked. No key. I told her so. She told me to look where my father had been hiding. Flickering candle in hand, I crawled under the bed to the far corner where my father had been hiding. But I found no key on the earthen floor. Where was the key? Had my father unwittingly taken it with him? How would I get my mother out? "There's no key where he was, Mama," I shouted from under the bed. "Look again." Pause. "And thoroughly this time." Before resuming the search, I spat twice on my right palm and patted the spittle with my left forefinger, watching to see where the most spit went. It went to the right. I then uttered the supplication my mother had taught me. Ancestors, ancestors, guide me to whatever I'm looking for, wherever it may lie. I concentrated my search on the right side of the bed. Still no key. I became frantic. There's no key, Mama. She told me to look everywhere. I began ransacking the house, and while overturning the torn straw mattress, I found a pair of old, rusted keys in one of the holes. I tried them on the wardrobe lock. They wouldn't even fit. Finally, in exasperation, I went to the kitchen, grabbed a heavy wood axe, and went back to the bedroom, determined to chop the wardrobe down and get my mother out. Mama, should I chop the door down and let you out? I said fervently. Flora, standing nearby, shrieked with horror as I lifted the axe. No! My mother shrieked from inside the wardrobe. What should I do then? Look again! Look where? I've looked everywhere. Look again under the bed. I've looked there twice already. There's nothing there. Look again carefully.
Please look again, Johannes, my sister begged. I'll help you look.
Shut up, you. Reluctantly, I leaned the axe against the wardrobe door and crawled back under the bed. For ancestors' sake, I cried. Where's the key? I was now convinced that my father had unwittingly taken it with him. If he had, what then? My mother would just have to let me chop down the door. Didn't my father always say I chopped wood like a man? I don't know what made me look between the bricks propping up one leg of the bed. But in one of the crevices, I found a long, glistening key, along with several farthings, which I pocketed. The key slid easily into the lock. I turned it twice to the right, and then the knob. They both turned easily. The door swung open. My mother, clad only in her underwear, wriggled out from the tiny compartment where clothes would have been hanging, had we had any worth hanging. She stretched her numb legs and cracked her neck and back. She then dressed and quieted my brother by letting him suckle. Afterward, she went about the task of restoring a semblance of order to the mess the police had created. My father spent 2 months doing hard labor on a white man's potato farm for his past crimes. Chapter 4. Following that brutal encounter I had with them, the peri-urban police became a tormenting presence in my life. Whereas in the past, I had been more or less conscious of their presence in black life. As they stopped people in the streets and demanded passes, as they chased after thoughties and other hoodlums, as they raided shebeens in search of illicit liquor, and as they launched an occasional pass raid into the neighborhood, they now moved permanently into my consciousness. Scarcely a week passed without the neighborhood being invaded by waves of black and white policemen. They always came unannounced, at any time of day or night, and gradually I came to accept, and to dread, their presence as a way of life. They haunted me in real life and in my dreams. To the extent that I would often wake up screaming in the middle of the night, claiming that the police were after me with dogs and flashlights, trying to shoot me down. Word had it that our neighborhood, because of the increasing presence of people whose papers were not in order, had been designated a hotspot, which meant that it had to be raided constantly. So, barely 6 years old, I was called upon to deal with constant terror. The year was 1966. By witnessing raid after raid, week in and week out,
month after month. I began learning from my parents ways of recognizing and interpreting specific cues about the movement of police once they had invaded the neighborhood, so I could react swiftly and warn my parents or fabricate ingenious lies to prevent them from searching the house. Other children, 3, 4, 5, and 6 years old, were being taught the same lessons by their parents. Whenever we were out at play, we were expected to act as sentries. Whenever the policemen came, other children would scamper homeward shouting, "Mama, Papa, the police are coming, the police are coming." But I failed to do the same. That brutal encounter with the police had left indelible scars. The mere sight of police vans now had the power of blanking my mind, making me forget all I had learned, making me rely on my instincts, which invariably told me to flee, to cower, lest I end up face to face with a policeman and get flogged. I became a useless sentry. But it did not matter, for the raids, now launched incessantly into our neighborhood, had an uncanny element of surprise. That the police would come was a certain effect as the sun rising in the morning. What black people didn't know, and would have given everything in the world to know, was when and with how strong a force. Each time the police launched a raid into the neighborhood, my mother, by some miracle, would manage to escape in the nick of time. She seemed to always have premonitions of their coming, and would forewarn my father. "You know," my mother would say, "I have a feeling Periaben will visit us this week." "There you go again," my father would retort. "Would you stop being paranoid, woman? They were here just last week. How can they come again this week? Need I remind you that we are not the only people living in Alexandria?" "Suit yourself," my mother would say. "Don't say I didn't warn you. You said the same last time, and didn't they nearly pick you up? If you hadn't left for work before they came, they would have. Anyways, I'm not the only one who has these dreams of their coming. Many other women do, and they tell their husbands." My father would then say, "Have you women stopped and told yourselves that maybe the police keep on coming because you women think about them so often?" My mother would then reply, "What else is there to think about?" My father's response was more or less typical of that of other men in the yard. So when my mother and other women in the yard sought ways of escaping from the police, at times hiding in ditches, at times in outhouses, at times in trees, at times on rooftops, at times in secret underground hollows, and at times waking in the middle of the night and leaving home to drift along some faraway street until the police were gone, he and other men would frown and, with affectations of bravery, continue with business as usual. For a long time, I did not understand why my father and other men acted this way, until one day I heard talk among the women folk that the real reason why their husbands refused to run away was that they considered it cowardly and unmanly to run away from other men. The police, whenever my mother forebode, would indeed come, and many of the men of the yard would be caught napping, surrendering themselves with lamb-like submission. Some of the men, my father occasionally among them, would pay hefty bribes to the policemen and would be let go. Sometimes my father would escape arrest because, since his last arrest, he now left for work at 3 o'clock in the morning and would not return until 8 or 9 at night, when most of the raids had already taken place. But other men were not so lucky. They had no money, having paid it all out in bribes over the course of many arrests. They would be carted in vans and trucks to Number 4,
a notorious prison for black people in Johannesburg. Repeat offenders and those whose passbook crimes were considered more serious would be processed to a maximum security penitentiary called Moda B on the outskirts of Kempton Park. I would often hear the women folk say that Moda B was a hell which changed black men into brutes, no matter how tough and stubborn they may be. Almost every night, before we went to bed, whenever my mother happened to have one of her premonitions, she would pray in earnest to our ancestral spirits that the day never come when my father would be sent to Moda B. "Will prayer stop the police from coming, Mama?" I asked one evening. Somehow I had the vague feeling that all my mother's prayers were useless, that no amount of prayer could stop the police from violating our lives at will. "No," my mother replied.
"Then why do you pray?"
"I don't know." Despite the terror of Periaben, the lives of my family, neighbors and community continued to ebb and flow along a predictable, monotonous course. On Mondays, the blacks of Alexandra, my parents included, continued having Babalazi, Blue Monday hangover, after a weekend of feasting on Bantu beer and Western liquor in the Shebeens. Much of this sottish drinking was meant to drown sorrows and forget the troubles and hardships of black life. On Tuesdays, itinerant butchers continued coming by with their donkey or pushcarts, peddling heavy bones with scraps of meat on them, muhodu, kettle's lungs, pig's knuckles, giblets and chitlings. And black women in tribal garb continued erecting their stalls by the dusty street corners, selling cooked or roasted maize cobs, cooked yams and spinach and chicken feet, mostly to migrant laborers from the tribal reserves, who had no wives to cook for them. On Wednesday, the Chinaman continued coming, in his flashy American-made car, to the runners' homes to pick up bets and announce winners in the numbers game of Fafi. On Thursdays, kitchen girls and garden boys, dressed in their Sunday best, continued coming to the townships to spend their day off with their families and friends. On Fridays, black people continued to be paid for their toil in the white world, and Tsotsis and other muggers continued robbing them of their hard-earned pittance, often hacking and stabbing them to death. And on weekends, black people continued to feast and drink heavily in an effort to unwind and prepare for another week of hard labor in the white world. Chapter 5. One night, our dingy shack, which had been leaning precipitously on the edge of a donga, collapsed. Luckily, no one was hurt, but we were forced to move to another one, similarly built. This new shack, like the old one, had two rooms and measured something like 15 by 15 feet, and overlooked the same unlit, unpaved potholed street. It had an interior flaked with old whitewash, a leaky ceiling of rusted zinc propped up by a thin wall of crumbling adobe bricks. Two tiny windows made of cardboard and pieces of glass. A creaky, termite-eaten door too low for a person of average height to pass through without bending double. And a floor made of patches of cement and earth. It was similar to the dozen or so shacks strewn irregularly, like lumps on a leper, upon the cracked, greenless piece of ground named Yard Number 35. In this new shack, my brother George was weaned. It was amusing to witness my mother do it. The first day she began the process, she secretly smeared her breasts with red pepper and then invited my brother to suckle. Unsuspecting, George energetically attacked my mother's breast, only to let go of it instantly and start hollering because of the hot pepper. This continued throughout the day whenever he wanted to suckle. Finally, after a few days, he began to dread the sight of my mother's breast, and each time she teased him with it, he would turn his face. He was now weaned. My father bought a small white chicken. My mother brewed beer. A few relatives were invited, and a small celebration was held to mark George's passage from infancy to childhood. He was almost 2 years old. He now had to sleep with Flora and me in the kitchen. Soon after George was weaned, my father began teaching him, as he had been teaching me, tribal ways of life. My father belonged to a loosely knit group of black families in the neighborhood, to whom tribal traditions were a way of life, and who sought to bring up their offspring according to its laws. He believed that feeding us a steady diet of tribal beliefs, values, and rituals was one way of ensuring our normal growth, so that in the event of our returning to the tribal reserve, something he insistently believed would happen soon, we would blend in perfectly. This diet he administered religiously, seemingly bent on molding George and me in his image. At first I had tried to resist the diet, but my father's severe looks frightened me. A short, gaunt figure, with a smooth, tight, black as coal skin, large prominent jaws, thin uneven lips whose sole function seemed to be the production of sneers, a broad nose with slightly flaring nostrils, small bloodshot eyes which never cried, small close-set ears, and a wide prominent forehead. Such were my father's fearsome features. Born and bred in a tribal reserve, and nearly twice my mother's age, my father existed under the illusion, formed as much by a strange innate pride as by a blindness to everything but his own will, that someday all white people would disappear from South Africa, and black people would revert to their old ways of living. To prepare for this eventuality, he ruled the house strictly according to tribal law, tolerating no deviance, particularly from his children. At the same time that he was force-feeding us tribalism, we were learning other ways of life, modern ways, from mingling with children whose parents had shed their tribal cloth and embraced Western culture. My father's tribal rule had as its fulcrum the constant performing of rituals spanning the range of day-to-day living. There were rituals to protect the house from evildoers, to ward off starvation, to prevent us from becoming sick, to safeguard his job, to keep the police away, to bring us good luck, to make him earn more money, and many others which my young mind could not understand. Somehow they did not make sense to me. They simply awed, confused, and embarrassed me. And the only reason I participated in them night after night was because my father made certain that I did. By using, among other things, the whip and the threat of the retributive powers of my ancestral spirit, whose favor the rituals were designed to carry. Along with the rituals, there were also tribal laws governing manners. One day I intentionally broke one of these laws. I talked while eating. "That's never done in my house," my father screamed at me as he rose from the table where he had been sitting alone, presiding over our meal. I was eating pap and flace out of the same bowl with George and Flora. We were sitting on the floor, about the brazier, and my mother was in the bedroom doing something. "You don't have 2 mouths to afford you such luxury," he fumed, advancing threateningly toward me, a cold sneer on his thin-lipped, cankerous mouth. He seemed 10 feet tall. Terrified, I deserted the pup and fleece and fled to my mother. "Bring him back here, woman," my father called through the door as he unbuckled his rawhide belt. "He needs to be taught how to eat properly." I began bawling, sensing I was about to be whipped. My mother led me into the kitchen and pleaded for me. "He won't do it again. He's only a child, and you know how forgetful children are." At this point, George and Flora stopped eating and watched with petrified eyes. "Don't give me that," snarled my father. "He's old enough to remember how to eat properly." He tore me away from my mother and lashed me. She tried to intervene, but my father shoved her aside and promised her the same. I never finished my meal. Sobbing, I slunk off to bed, my limbs afire with pain where the rawhide had raised welts. The next day, as I nursed my wounds, while my father was at work, I told my mother that I hated him and promised her I would kill him when I grew up. "Don't say that," my mother reprimanded me. "I will," I said stoutly. "If you won't, leave me alone." "He's your father, you know." "He's not my father." "Shut that bad mouth of yours," my mother threatened to smack me. "Why does he beat me then?" I protested. "Other fathers don't beat their children." My friends always boasted that their fathers never laid a hand on them. "He's trying to discipline you. He wants you to grow up to be like him." "What? Me? Never!" I shook with indignation. "I'm never going to be like him. Why should I?" "Well, in the tribes, sons grow up to be like their fathers." "But we are not living in the tribes." "But we're still of the tribes." "I'm not," I said. Trying to focus the conversation on rituals, my nemesis, I said, after a thoughtful pause, "Is that why Papa insists that we do rituals?" "Yes. But other people don't." "Everybody does rituals, Mr. Matabane," my mother said. "You just don't notice it because they do theirs differently. Even white people do rituals." "Why do people do rituals, Mama?" "People do rituals because they were born in the tribes. And in the tribes, rituals are done every day. They are a way of life." "But we don't live in the tribes," I countered. "Papa should stop doing rituals." My mother laughed. "Well, it's not as simple as that. Your father grew up in the tribes, as you know. He didn't come to the city until he was quite old. It's hard to stop doing things when you're old." "I too do rituals because I was raised in the tribes." "The meaning, child, will become clear as you grow up. Have patience." But I had no patience with rituals, and I continued hating them. Participation in my father's rituals sometimes led to the most appalling scenes, which invariably made me the laughingstock of my friends, who thought that my father, in his ritual garb, was the most hilarious thing they had ever seen since natives in Tarzan movies. Whenever they laughed at me, I would feel embarrassed and would cry. I began seeking ways of distancing myself from my father's rituals. I found one. I decided I would no longer, in the presence of my friends, speak Venda, my father's tribal language. I began speaking Zulu, Sotho, and Tsonga, the languages of my friends. It worked. I was no longer an object of mockery. My masquerade continued until my father got wind of it. "My boy," he began, "who is ruler of this house?"
You are, Papa, I said with a trembling voice. Whose son are you? Yours and Mama's. Whose? Yours. That's better. Now tell me, which language do I speak? Venda. Which does your Mama speak? Venda. Which should you speak? Venda. Then why do I hear you speaking other tongues? Are you a prophet? Before I could reply, he grabbed me and lashed me thoroughly. Afterwards, he threatened to cut out my tongue if he ever again heard I wasn't speaking Venda. As further punishment, he increased the number of rituals I had to participate in. I hated him more for it. Chapter 6. Toward the end of 1966, my father was temporarily laid off his job as a menial laborer for a white firm in Germiston, a white city an hour's bus ride southeast of Johannesburg. He had been told by his boss, that he would be recalled as soon as the reorganization of the firm was complete. It was coming under new ownership. The first few weeks, my father stayed at home awaiting the recall. It never came. As weeks slid past, he began making plans to seek another job, thinking that he had been permanently laid off. But first, he had to go to BAD, Bantu Affairs Department, to obtain a permit to do so. I was out in the streets playing soccer one weekday afternoon when Flora came running up to me, crying. She told me that something terrible had happened at home, and I was wanted immediately. When I reached home, I found my mother pacing mechanically about the shack, murmuring helplessly, desperately, uncontrollably, clasping and unclasping her hands. It cannot be. No, it cannot be. Not my husband, not my husband, she was saying to herself. What happened to Papa, Mama? I said with fright as I flung myself at her. I thought that maybe he had been killed. For a while, my mother did not answer. But finally, she controlled her emotions and, between sobs, told me what had happened. My father had been arrested that morning at the bus stop for being unemployed. A man who had been with him as they waited for the bus to Johannesburg to apply for permits had brought my mother the grim news. The man's story was as follows. As he and my father waited for the bus, several police vans suddenly swooped upon the bus stop. People fled in all directions. My father was nabbed as he tried to leap a fence. His pass was scanned and found to contain an out-of-work stamp. He was taken in. His crime, unemployment, was one of the worst a black man could commit. My mother sent me to fetch my father's relatives, with the hope that they might find some way to secure his release. The relatives came but couldn't help. Neither could our neighbors. What would happen to him now? I asked my mother. She told me not to worry, that my father would come back home after serving the customary 4 weeks sentence for being unemployed. 4 weeks went by, and still he had not come back. We began to worry. My mother wept every night. We children cried along with her. No word of his whereabouts came for yet another week. Suspecting the worst, that my father had been sent to Moda B, my mother lost faith in herself and began to despair of our future. Things will be very different without your father, children. We did not understand, and we simply cried and grew frightened. Pangs of hunger melted my resentment of my father away. And now that he was gone, I longed night and day for his return.
I didn't even mind his coming back and shouting restrictions at me and making me perform rituals. I simply wanted him back. And as days slid by without him, as I saw other children in the company of their fathers, I would cry. His absence showed me how much I loved him. I never stopped asking questions about when he would be coming back. One afternoon, after it had been 2 months since I last saw my father, and we were now on rations, I asked my mother, "When will Papa be back?" "I don't know," my mother said sadly. "He may be gone for a long, long time." "Why does he get arrested so much?" "Because his past is not in order." "Why doesn't he get it fixed?" "He can't." "Why?" "You're too young to know." "What's a pass, Mama?" I knew vaguely what a pass was, but not its reality. "It's an important book that we black people must have in order, always, and carry with us all the time." She took out hers and showed it to me. I remembered seeing the book. In fact, I remembered seeing it many times. And yet, each time I saw it, it appeared dreadfully new. There was something about it which made me fearful, helpless. But I could not figure out what about it made me feel that way. It seemed a mere book. Yet it was, I was later to find out, the black man's passport to existence. Naively, I told my mother that I did not have a pass, suggesting that the police would not take me away. "You'll have to get one when you turn 16. "Will they take me away too, Mama? Like they do, Papa?" "Hush. You're asking too many questions for your own good." My father's latest arrest, true to my mother's predictions, changed our lifestyle drastically. Lunch was now out of the question. So was breakfast. And having pap and flace became a sporadic, chancy luxury. My mother, who for some reason could not get a permit to work in Johannesburg, could not even afford to buy tea and brown bread. There came many days when we ate nothing at all, spending the long evening hours simply staring at one another, at the empty pots, and at the sun going down. George, Flora, and I resorted to eating our own mucus. Each day we spent without food drove us closer and closer to starvation. Then terror struck. I began having fainting spells. I would be out playing when suddenly my head would feel light. My knees would wobble. My vision would dim and blur, and down I would come like a log. My playmate would then run away in shock. I would be told when I woke up, screaming that I was dead. My mother would then come and revive me, usually by pouring cold water over me, or slapping me on the cheeks, or both. But there was sometimes a good part to my blackouts. Whenever I fainted near a store, I would get a piece of candy or fruit from the storekeeper upon reviving. Naturally, I loved fainting near stores. But my storefront fainting spells became so frequent that storekeepers, for fear of going broke, I suppose, no longer gave me anything. One day I asked my mother if we had any savings, and she replied that we did not have a cent, that we were a hand-to-mouth household, that when my father had been around, he had spent all his money on food, on paying rent, on bus fare, and on police bribes. I suggested that she borrow money from other people. "Who?" she asked. "Our neighbors," I answered. She broke into a laugh, like that of a person being driven mad by hunger. and said, "Show me a black man with a penny to spare, and I'll bring your father back." My father's long imprisonment began to wreak daily nightmares on everybody in the house. Without income, we could no longer afford the rent for our dingy shack. One afternoon, the landlord, a fat, grey-haired, no-nonsense Mosotho man, came and told us that we would have to pack and leave at the end of the week, unless we came up with his money. He said he had the longest list of people waiting to grab the shack at any price. And he wasn't lying. Since word got around that we could not afford to pay rent, there had been a steady stream of shack seekers at the custodian's door. My mother begged him to give us at least a month's extension, pointing out that eviction would automatically result in the family being endorsed out of Alexandra, back to a tribal reserve. "We have nowhere to go back there," my mother implored. "This is our only home. Please let us stay. We'll get you the money somehow." The landlord relented and gave us until the end of the month to come up with the 3 months' rent we owed him. One weekday afternoon, while my mother was out hunting for food and money to pay rent, and Flora, George, and I were left alone in the house, 2 tall, powerful, belligerent Zulu men, armed with spears and pangas, machetes, burst into the house and demanded to see my father. "He isn't home," I said with bated breath. George and Flora burst out crying. "Your mother?" "She too." They looked about the kitchen for a couple moments and then stepped into the bedroom. They came back to the kitchen, wielding the pangas and spears. George, Flora, and me clung to each other in terror. "When they get back, tell them we've been here." I nodded vigorously. Without saying another word, they proceeded to strip the house of furniture, seizing the wardrobe, chairs, and table, saying that the goods were payment for a mysterious debt of honor my father owed them. My mother came back, and I told her what had happened. There was nothing she could do to retrieve the furniture, she said. She could not even report the matter to the police, she added, for it would mean producing her passbook, which was not in order. As she sat figuring out what to do, tears streaming down her cheeks, she said, "This is just the beginning." A few weeks later, George and Flora came down with a mysterious illness, which left them emaciated and lethargic, their stomachs so distended that I thought they would burst. Their bodies were covered with sores, which punctured and oozed pus, and their hair turned to a strange orange color. There were times when, while fanning off blowflies with a piece of cardboard from their filmy, half-closed eyes, mucus-covered noses and bruised mouths, while they lay writhing with pain on the damp cement floor, I thought I could see their tiny, empty intestines. Seeing them like that made me cry. Occasionally, they excreted live worms with their bloody stools. Their tearing coughs kept everyone awake at night. Each time my mother gave them a morsel of food, whenever she could get it, they vomited. Their suffering made the days and nights unbearably long and gloomy. My mother did not have the 100 cents to take them to the clinic, and no witch doctor, our last resort, was willing to treat them on credit. But with determination, courage, and love, she tried her best to nurse them back to health using some herbs Granny gave her. My brother and sister fought with the tenacity typical of African children to stay alive. But I wondered for how long. The strangest thing was that, except for a minor cough, I felt fine. My father's arrest had come in September, and when Christmas was but 2 days away, my mother dropped a bombshell.
"There won't be any Christmas celebration this year," she said.
"What?" I cried, reacting as if I were a convict and my mother a judge condemning me to death for a crime I didn't commit.
Each Christmas, black families would celebrate by taking children of all ages to the Indian place on First Avenue to be outfitted with cheap garments and some, the extremely lucky ones, with sneakers or shoes.